Blog Talk Radio.
We would like to welcome everyone to Africa on Your Move. As your host, Brother Africa, we are coming to you live and direct. That's right, live and direct from our mother. We want to speak to you today in terms of doing a special edition of Africa on the Move. As relate to, we decided to highlight at least a minimum of three topics and one event tonight, which we believe these ideals are having a profound impact on our community and on our people. We'd like to get a dialogue. We'd like to have a serious dialogue with the community on these ideas and concepts. And one of the ideas and concepts that we're going to discuss, the first one is going to be on black success stories really holding us back. This was a story or report that was done in the Black Agenda Report recently, which I thought was really interesting in terms of this whole question of looking at how do we, how should we celebrate, or how should we define, or how should we project so-called what we call success stories, and what are the implications of them, positive and negative, particularly when you live in a society where 95% of all things that are spoken about us are normally on the negative side. So we like to have that critical dialogue and be very analytical in terms of having discussed this article. That article will be followed by a second article called The McClutching Ruling and Zombie Democracy in the U.S. This was an article that was recently published, and in it, it critiques and talk about the mythology of democracy in the U.S. and some of its contradiction, but I think more critically, we must ask ourselves, how do the ruling elite are able to create a climate where we all just about fall for the okey-doke, and how can we overcome it? The article was last be followed by an article called Milwaukee as a Third World Country. Article was sent to me earlier by a friend of mine, Sister Rose Lee, which when we read this article, I thought it creates some real interesting dialogue in terms of not only looking at Milwaukee, but I think we maybe want to look at all the states that we live under and what we have in common in terms of this question of whether or not if Milwaukee is a plantation or not. So we can have a dialogue on those three articles, and followed by last but not least, the upcoming event, African Liberation Day 2014. We'd like to have a dialogue on what's going on this year for African Liberation Day, and we also would like to know if you plan on supporting it and how you can best support it. So this is going to be the agenda for tonight. Sit back, relax, and later on we'll open up our phone lines at 232-679-0841. We'd like to have your views on these issues and ideas. We believe it's important for us to discuss these ideas because they're one of the contradictions among inner oppressed people, and particularly African people, is around this question of ideas, the confusion. Only once we have unity of thought, we would then be in position to have unity of action. At this point in time, this question of unity of thought is a very important issue that we must struggle and raise. And once we get this, I believe our events fall in place and fall under the action, seek the political kingdom first. That's not to say we don't address the economic question, but we understand anything is a process. So in that note, for tonight, we'd like to entertain these ideals so we can have a better clarity and understanding as a people. We talk about collective development. We're not talking about individual development. So with us tonight, we have our panelists, Africa on the Move tonight. We have with us Brother Haki, Brother Jabari, Brother Mel, and Brother Anthony. They are on the line now, right now with us. And we'd like to welcome everybody to Africa on the Move. Brother Haki, for those who may not know you, and maybe listen to the show for the first time, please, 1 minute statement, introduce yourself to our community.
Yeah, I've been involved in the struggle for our community for over 30 years now. I focus primarily on the empowerment of the community and the kind of things we need to do. I'm a big advocate of creating institutions in the neighborhood to combat a lot of the social inequality that exists in our communities.
Okay, next, Brother Zimbabwe, introduce yourself to our listening audience.
A student researcher, and I'm a strong advocate of seeking out what we do to get the youth and young adults involved in our struggle.
Okay, next, we have Brother Mayo. Introduce yourself to the community, to our listening audience.
Yes, I'm Mel Smith, Melvin W. Smith. I'm a teacher and a former organizer. I'm an elder. I've arrived at the elder stage of my life, and I'm a writer and a person who has worked and lived around the country and in various states of employment, and I'm constantly and continuing in the area of social justice and liberation, black liberation.
And last but not least, we have Brother Anthony. Brother Anthony, can you briefly introduce yourself to our listening audience?
Certainly. Revolutionary greetings. I am an organizer for the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC, and I've been participating in the struggle to achieve Pan-Africanism for over 30 years.
Okay, good. Let's jump straight into the fire. The first article we'd like to discuss, we'd like to get your assessment and analysis on this article. It's an article that was recently produced in Black Agenda Report. And the title of the article is Black Success Stories Really Holding Us Back. It was an article that was written by the author, Bruce A. Dixon. And in the article, he made some points that I think are very important in terms of having discussion in terms of how do we publicize success stories. First, how do we define them? And two, how do we publicize it? And what is the implications of what happens in terms of how we publicize them? And one of the things I'd like to raise from this particular article, he made a statement there. He said, black billionaires simply do not lift up the masses of Africans or of African Americans. Only collective actions on the part of ordinary people can do this. Brother Haki, what can you make of that statement?
Well, I think I'm in agreement. In terms of the things that you articulated, I think one of the problems is that all too often, as a means of control, those in power utilize this whole notion of individuality. In other words, that in order to achieve in society, to make wealth, to achieve status, that you have to do it. It only can be done individually. And it's a very, very crazy idea in terms of looking at human development. That is what the power structure pushes. I think the danger is that as more and more of our people internalize the notion in terms of achieving things individually, then you carte blanche, you give support to all kind of negative attributes, all kind of negative sayings, all kind of negative cliches, which tends to exploit as opposed to enlighten, as opposed to bringing people into consciousness. So I think, as a black billionaire, that's all in good. But the question is, I'm coming to a billionaire. The question is, what are you doing in terms of becoming a billionaire? And also the question is, in terms of being a billionaire, what type of benefits do you offer those in the community who are, in fact, marginalized, economic and otherwise? So I think one of the things is that the system is very, 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 very skilled in terms of the ability, in terms of raising up, this notion in terms of, you're making it. And for instance, if you look at the African community, in particular with respect to rap music, you see a lot of young brothers and sisters with aspirations to do one of two things. It's to play sports or it's to be a rapper. And the question is, why are young people fixated on this notion of being a rapper or a sports individual? Well, it's clear. I mean, the implication is that you can accrue a lot of money by participating in those particular venues. But the problem is that even if you participate in those venues, what are the concrete benefits in terms of the mass of the people? And this is the problem. So consequently, if you've got a rapper, you got a situation where the kind of lyrics that these kids pump out are counterproductive. They don't serve the interests of the aspirations of their people, but they certainly serve the interests and aspirations of the ruling class or the corporate class. And so, therefore, you know, those in power understand that it's in their interest to make damn sure that certain ideas get propagated, and in particular the idea in terms of, you know, it's all about me, you know, I'll do me, you know, and all those kind of things that a lot of times you hear kids articulate in the community. So we got to be careful about that. And also I think that in terms of those individuals who are very, very wealthy in the African community, in terms of how you get there, now, if I got a business, I'm making tons and tons of money. But if I'm paying my people, you know, $7.10 an hour, $7.25 an hour, what concrete benefits do they derive? Or let's say if I had a restaurant and I serve food that is subpar, that I know does lacking in nutrition, that does more harm than good, but I make lots of money. What tangible benefits do I realistically expect, you know, the community to accrue? They don't. They don't accrue any benefits. In fact, the only benefit is to me, which is that I make lots of money at the expense of a community. And so, therefore, it's nothing wrong in terms of the fact, in terms of, you know, if in fact you're going to do things that empower the community. But to the extent that you disempower the community in terms of your pursuit of wealth, there is no concrete difference between that exploitation practiced by, you know, by African people versus the exploitation practiced by Europeans in terms of their pursuit of money. So they can be very, very careful in terms of how they, you know, these people in terms of, you know, in terms of quote-unquote being successful.
Brother Mayor, what is your take on this question there? Black billionaires simply do not lift up the masses of Africans or African-Americans. Only collective actions on the part of ordinary people can do that.
Yeah, but Aki has laid it out just beautifully. That's the problem. Our educational system, for example, kind of reflects that problem in that emphasis on the individual, the great man theory, and such. For example, in history courses, the way history is taught largely, especially in the lower grades, the elementary and secondary levels. You have for example, Howard Zinn's book, A People's History, is the antithesis of that, because he is talking about history of the United States from the perspective of the grassroots, the people, a collective approach to the telling of history. And that's a very different thing. And it deals with this matter of a collective and the needs of a people, which certainly is not being represented by these individual millionaires. But this is the carrot. This is the system, of capitalism in particular. And that fosters the idea that you can be successful, quote unquote, by being rich, and therefore happy. Happiness is always attached to this idea, this myth, and this is promoted heavily, just as Zadaki indicated. Our young people are following that carrot in very narrow and self-destructive ways. That we need a great effort to break out of it. But much of it is the mindset, a mindset that is being promoted, continues to be promoted, of following that carrot with these carefully sculptured, manipulated concepts of well-being, which are not well-being for the whole, but well-being for a small class of people whose intention and obvious progress is toward the full spectrum domination. And that means the manifest destiny to continue their onslaught on the world, and the capture of all the world's resources for this class, and now it's multinational. But it's the same old story. We are we're in a fight of ideas as well as of material. These wealthy individuals are used as symbols, and as perhaps I've used the term before to reference one of our so-called leaders. That's Judas Goat. That's the old concept of having folks follow a false leader to their detriment, and that may be what's happening to us. As I fear that is what's happening to us, and that's how these people are being used.
Okay, as we discuss this article, Black Success Stories Really Holding Us Back by Brother Bruce A. Dixon, I would like to make our audience aware a little bit about the article, and I'd like to read the first two paragraphs, and I would like for our other panelists to chime in on this, on these two paragraphs. I'd like to get their response. He started off with a quote. He said, "How twisted are we to abhor Herman Cain while we uncritically praise the Black fast food entrepreneurs who pay his fat salary?" Then it starts this way. He said, "A couple of weeks ago, a friend of mine, both an actual friend and a Facebook friend, posted a link to an online story about Junior Bridgman. He's a Black former NBA player who, instead of squandering his pro ball money like some do, used it to build a $400 million fast food empire, which by now includes about 160 Wendy's and 120 Chili's restaurants. My friend offered the link, paraphrasing him only a little, as something inspirational, as a accompanying table of purpose and hard work rewarded the kind of Black man make good success story that ought to be brightened everybody day. Except it didn't make me feel all that good. I feel a lot better about the success story. I said, if there was any reason to believe the condition in Bridgman fast food empire were quite unlike those in the rest of the fast food universe. Did Bridgman pay his workers a living wage, say at least $15 an hour? Does his workers have affordable medical benefits? Are his managers trained not to steal hours and wages from workers, as is pretty common in that industry? As the single biggest Wendy franchisee, I know that Bridgman likely has paid hundreds of thousands in yearly dues to the Fast Food Restaurant Trade Association, which they use to lobby elected officials to keep his worker wages low. And it works. Well, Junior, anyway, the federal minimum wage for tip workers has stayed around $2.31 an hour for more than 20 years. I'll stop right there. To the rest of the panelists, maybe Anthony and Jabari, can y'all give me y'all position on, is that a fair critique, fair criticism, in terms of how it's been waged, in terms of criticizing so-called African businessmen?
I would say absolutely. And the reason that I feel that it is a fair critique is, as the article was stating, you look at the condition that these workers often find themselves in. You know, a lot of them sometimes are young people or people that have been in and out of the penal system for one reason or another, and they are trying to adapt in a society that is often harsh and cruel to them. Instead of trying to work with them and find a way for them to be productive, oftentimes society finds new means of demonizing them or putting them down. And that's why you notice you heard rhetoric like Ronald Reagan say the poverty pimps and welfare queens and things of that nature. Of course, that's referring to people of color. But you still notice that trend of racism, oppression, and people being held down. And just because there's a so-called success story of a person of color, you have to look at the conditions that led to the person of color amassing this great fortune that they did.
Okay. What about Anthony? What's your take? Is that fair criticism?
I think it is indeed a valid criticism. Of African business men and business women in general. Let's see. I mean, I don't think we pay close enough attention to how these various, African millionaires and billionaires amass their wealth. I mean, it definitely does not uplift the people because a lot of times they acquire their wealth by doing the same things to Africans that millionaires and billionaires of other nationalities do. They exploit our suffering, as Aki alluded to earlier. If you operate businesses that do not serve food that's healthy for people, then our people obviously don't benefit. It only benefits that individual and his immediate associates around him. But it does nothing to uplift the conditions of the masses of our people. And that could be applied to the entertainment industry as well. I mean, the type of music that's being put out, it makes the individual artists a lot of money, but it does nothing to improve the conditions of the masses of our people. As a matter of fact, it makes it worse. I mean, when you put out material that denigrates, men, women, the way some of the material does, or that plays on, certain stereotypes that have, devastated our community culturally for centuries, it definitely does not do anything to help our people. As a matter of fact, it serves as a smokescreen because it spreads confusion. Because people only look at the image and the numbers, but don't pay attention to how these people actually amass their wealth.
Okay, I'd like to direct this question to Brother Mayor and Brother Haki for right now. If someone would listen to this critique and listen to discussion, often they will argue the point of view that, we need more black businesses. How are we going to create wealth if we don't own? Because one of the basic premises of capitalism is ownership and producing. What would be your response to this question of what is the alternative if we can't own our own businesses? Or if this concept of owning businesses is viewed as being something negative, how do you deal with that psychological perception of people seeing businesses owned by African people as being something anti, not pro? What is it? The essence of because of that structure, fundamentally, something's wrong with this process. Brother Haki and Brother Mayo, can y'all respond to that? Brother Mayo, go ahead.
Well, yeah, I think it can be kind of a catch-22 situation, but we're in a situation that is a capitalist situation. There are businesses and can be businesses that are honorable and that they do aim at advancing the people, and that has been done by some business people, in our history. At least at one time, for example, the black press was definitely about that. It's very questionable whether they are now. Certainly, generally, are not, and largely because there was a concentrated effort by the establishment, government included, to undermine the black press, and they successfully have done that, and that's materially, economically, and in terms of political perspective. In a lot of cases, we have very few now that are really forthright freedom fighting organs for the people, those tend to be very small and very challenged, you know, economically. But that there can be certain business enterprises that are developed to serve the people's needs generally, but that almost flies in the face of the capitalist project, which essentially commands corporations and businesses to serve the bottom line first and foremost. That's what business is about, according to the American manual. It's the bottom line. They get money, they get profit, and that in itself is sacred, and therefore they march forward with that idea. And this is part of the problem with business for our people. We get caught up in that mantra and in that practice, and as such get absorbed into a mainstream that is, again, detrimental to our survival, much less our development. So it's more than just a touchy thing. Certainly, we need to be developing another means of production and social development, and that's the other story. That means that maybe there could be businesses, but the major thrust of our development as a people probably needs to be something other than through business.
Yeah. Brother Haki, your response.
Yeah, well, you know, I think black business is a legitimate expression of the needs of African people, and there's no question about that. I think just in terms of as a startup, I mean, clearly you know, it takes a business that generally anywhere from, 4 to 5 years in terms of getting off the ground. And so in the process of starting, of course, that you may be in a position where you can pay people a decent salary, or maybe you only can pay them, minimum wage, and that's, and certainly that's understandable, because the needs in terms of black employment is extremely important in the African community. But I think that when you get to the point where you're making substantial amounts of money, I mean big sums of money, you're making, hundreds of thousands of dollars, millions or billions of dollars a year, then clearly your responsibility, to your people, your responsibility to humanity should broaden. So that's the problem I have with someone like with Junior Bridgman. Now, in a more insidious side in terms of, this whole process in terms of, job creation, one of the things that's very, very interesting is that as you make more and more money, you got to do something with that money. You're not free to truly, just simply sit on the money. It has to be invested. Otherwise you end up paying a tremendous amount of taxes. So you're constantly searching for ways in which, or shelters in which you can preserve as much of your wealth as you possibly can. And that's understandable. I think that the system, inadvertently, what it does, it discourages, people from, actually expanding. Because as you place investments, in the system, a lot of the things you're doing behind the scene in terms of, interest rates, in terms of derivatives, I mean, all kinds of instruments they use, financial instruments that they employ, it's all a corrupt process. In fact, money's being skimmed off the top all the time, in particular from Federal Reserve, so-called investment banks. So it's a lot in conclusion with the U.S. government. So a lot of things going on behind the scenes that sort of negates against using that kind of wealth that you accrue to actually expand employment for African people. So this is one of the fundamental problems I think someone like Junior Bridgman will have in terms of, possibly giving a higher salary, because the whole thing is that, there's so much uncertainty that if you give all of your salary, all your wealth away in terms of wages, then it may be problematic in terms of your longevity in terms of business. Now, that's not to make an excuse, for people who engage in exploitation of African people, and that's not what I'm saying. I'm just trying to be objective in terms of understanding, the need for African businesses, but coupled with the reality in terms of what it means to have access to large sums of money, under this capitalist system, under this global economic system that we live under. So I think that's one of the problems that sort of makes it very difficult for people, to actually, create the kind of businesses that we would like to see in the community in terms of being able to actually pay people a reasonable wage. So I think it's a very difficult question, but to get back to your question, no question about it. We need African businesses. I mean, it's good for our youth. I mean, to see, you know, African people, you know, in positions, you know, in positions of authority, you know, making decisions in terms of employment, you know, so forth and so on. I mean, when you look at the history of terms of people, and when you look at, you know, Richmond, Virginia was one of the outstanding places for black businesses historically. Omaha was also, the Black Wall Street was very, very instrumental in terms of the preservation of black businesses in terms of being very proficient in how you do it. Even if you go further back into history and you look at the Port Royal experiment and you look at the terms of how African people practice business and their ability to use the money in terms of business they created to create education, you know, make sure everybody was educated, to make sure everybody had hospital care, to make sure everybody had shelter, homes to live in. So when you look at the history in terms of, you know, African businesses in terms of using money for the good, there's a history in terms of us being doing that. We don't have to succumb to this paradigm which says that, you know, we have to be like everybody else in terms of our business principles.
Okay, we now have a sister with us. We'd like to welcome Sister Katie Fulton to Africa on the Move. We are discussing this article that dealing with this whole question of what we call successful stories, where it relates to successful Africans being successful business people. There's a story that was titled Black Success Stories Really Holding Us Back. Ms. Fulton, you have had a chance to hear some of these views and comments. What is your take on that?
I do appreciate the comments that I've heard so far. I do understand also that economics is really the key to the survival of our nation. And for whatever reason, that's an institution in itself. I refer to the fact that a lot of our people, black people, have really and truly achieved a great deal of success when it comes to their profession, whether they are playing ball or whether they're in the movies or they're in the music industry. And I don't have to tell you that just a few days ago, Beyonce was on the cover of a very famous magazine, and that's a success story, meaning that they have achieved a level of income that brings recognition to their talent. I think that it's hard for people and the norm to understand how it is that that success is not trickled down into the community. Often there's a disconnect. We don't know how to tap in to that kind of income. And if you are able to tap into that income, it's short-lived. And that's unfortunate. Because
okay,
all these institutions apply to each other.
Thank you, Ms. Fulton. Let me just read another point from this article. And I'd like for Brother Anthony and Brother Zabari to respond to this, because I think it ties into this whole question of the legitimacy of so-called businesses, if there is a legitimate one. It says that in the real world of the first black president and unprecedented numbers of black faces in high military, corporate, and government positions, black child poverty is rising, not falling. Black unemployment is the same double white unemployment as it was 50 or 60 years ago, and climbing. In the real world, black women wages are catching up with black men wages only because black male unemployment is rising and their wages doing the opposite. Given all this, it should be clear to anybody without ideological blinders that lifting up black millionaires, black politicians, black entertainers, and celebrating black celebrities do not absolutely nothing to improve the lives of ordinary African people in America. Anthony, critique that. What is your response to that?
I think that's an accurate critique. I mean, the situation is there are probably more literate Africans at this point in our history in the Western Hemisphere than at any other time period. yet the conditions of the masses of our people are worsening. And that is because of the intensification of the exploitation by capitalism. And let's see, and that's why, you know, even though there are more African politicians, millionaires, business people, etc., the overall, the essence of the system remains the same, capitalism. And that and that is a system in which the bourgeoisie amasses its wealth by exploiting the majority of humanity. And that's what you see happening. And that's really the number of you know, the so-called high rollers is really very small in comparison to the majority of the people in society. And let's see, for the sake of this conversation, I'm limiting myself to that, to the Africans in the society at this point. But it's true of people in general. The masses of the people are suffering and are exploited. And those people who are employed, you know, are in constant fear of losing their ability to sustain themselves.
Okay.
Let me make my last comment here, because unfortunately I have to depart early tonight. But on this matter, we have one of the big problems with our attempt to emphasize a business. You know, at one point we had a big surge of black capitalism coming on to try to emphasize the business in our community, and much of that gained some boost for some people, but again, much like some of the politicians that we had a surge with, that did not develop the kinds of supports and gains in our community that we had hoped for and that we really need, largely because the system is not geared to benefit us as a collective, as a whole, but only a small group will benefit, and the larger group will not. Much of the capital that has been amassed, the wealth that's been amassed by a few people, has not been, as Sister Fulton said, there's a disconnect there. We can't seem to get it made useful in the community. Some of that has to do with the reality of capitalism and white supremacy. The white community has gained much from some of the largesse of wealthy white donors, philanthropists, who have contributed and to university endowments and the building of hospitals. Public auditoriums and theaters in cities and on university campuses and et cetera, et cetera. And those things have provided benefits to the public from the private wealth. The wealth of black folk has been so small by comparison in number and in amount that these things have not been forthcoming. Today we have fewer hospitals that are black operated and run than we had 50 years ago in this nation. For example, theaters and the like. It does not, it just isn't developed into that kind of thing. And even the wealthy and super wealthy entertainers and athletes don't seem to have the mindset to break the grip of their managers and advisors to begin to put their heads together to develop some of these things that are needed in our communities in terms of development for our communities. So that's, I think, one of the shortcomings of the emphasis on business, and perhaps something can be done about that. But I think we need to be thinking while we're thinking about those things. Definitely another mode of financial and economic operation that deals more with the needs of the whole and the development by the whole. So I hope that that's clear enough to, for me to say goodnight, and I appreciate being with all of you, talking with you, but I have to depart. Tonight.
Okay, Brother Mayor, we'd like to thank you for your contribution tonight as we begin to battle in this area of ideas so we can come better clear in terms of trying to reach this concept we call unity of thought and unity so we can have unity of action. Thank you for your contribution. In terms of making the transition, we'd like to transition from that article to the next article, which is the Clutchington ruling and zombie democracy in U.S., the Clutchington ruling and zombie democracy in the U.S. And often I think when we deal with the question of businesses, we got to talk about the environment in which it is operating under. If we don't address that, I think we will continue to be in this this pragmatism where we participate in entities that really set up and function as another means to continue to exploit and oppress their own people, even though we're trying to get out of this oppression. In the process of this particular article, I'd like to start with Brother Haki. When you read this particular article, Brother Haki, what were some of the things that stood out the most in terms of the issue or the point of view that the author was trying to make? By the way, the author name is Ajumu Baraku. What did you get from the article, Brother Haki?
Wait, refresh me on the article again.
The article is called The Clutchington Ruling and Zombie Democracy in the U.S. It's a critique on the U.S.
Yeah, the Clutchington ruling?
Yes.
But for those who don't know, just a year and a half ago, they came up with the Citizens United ruling. The Citizens United ruling, which says that corporations are defined as people. There's a very, very strange connotation, that the notion that you can call an entity a person. I mean, it's a very, very strange thing. But implicit in the ruling was this notion that, and I don't think people got that, was the fact that this is, in fact, a global economy. And as such, that because the wealth is transferred from the poorest to the wealthiest, then, of course, you have to give more power to those who are actually in control. But after all, what they're saying is that in terms of being an authentic democracy, then those in power should be making the rules. They should make the calls. And so, therefore, it's only fitting that they would use their wealth, or their wealth would be defined as speech. To most people, probably find it absurd. But now, you talk about this McCutcheon ruling, the whole notion is just Citizens United on steroids, in which now the few safeguards that existed in terms of preventing the wealthy from giving large sums of money to politicians has now been eradicated. Now they're free to do damn near anything they want to do in terms of buying elections. Here recently, a lot of the so-called Republicans, and don't get me wrong, there's not a difference between Republicans and Democrats in terms of the corruption, but recently some Republicans went out to Nevada to see this billionaire called Sheldon Adelson. Okay, and the whole notion was that he wanted to meet with them because he's wanting to size them up to determine who's worthy, getting his financial contributions. Who articulates, his needs, his desires? This guy owns casinos throughout the world. And so he liked to see, along in terms of a reduce in government regulation, he always liked to see that we get rid of any kind of online gambling because it affects his bottom line. So he's looking for politicians who are lockstep, in step in terms of the kind of things that he'd like to see done. So we had to understand that the McCutcheon is only indicative of the fact that we have a global economic system. Now, people don't understand, and I think one of the things I have to explain real briefly is that one of the things that happened behind the scenes is that every day this country prints up $85 million every day. Every day. Now, what impact does that have in terms of the value of the currency? it means that the more money they put out, the less value the currency have. So what happens is that a year ago, you might have bought a loaf of bread for $1.03, and today a loaf of bread costs you a little over $2. And so, therefore, that is indicative of the fact that the value of the currency isn't very, very much. But there's also another side to that, in a sense, when that happens, that those in positions of investment, those who buy the securities, who buy the bonds, make lots and lots of money. And so this is the problem that we're confronted with. And so, therefore, this McCutcheon ruling makes it possible for those to continue business as usual. And so those kind of crooked shenanigans that go on behind the scene, economically speaking, only continue to go forward, even at a more accelerated. So they understand that when they do that, what they're doing is tantamount to the destruction of the economy. But McCutcheon makes it possible for them to do this thing behind the scene by the same token, making tons and tons and tons of money. So this is why corporations are perceived as people, because those in the ruling class got a right in terms of capitalizing on this. Because after all, when you talk about democracy, democracy as it exists in America isn't a principle, it's a concept. When you look at the philosopher Democritus, where he talked about democracy was that people who rule, those in power, have a right to create a system in which they benefit. It's not about egalitarianism. It's not about the needs of the people in society. It's not about what's right. It's about the powerful ingratiating themselves in much power and much status and much wealth as they possibly can accrue. So we had to understand that McCutcheon ruling was indicative of that. And this is the economic reality we find themselves in. So I'm not surprised that the Roberts Court would do something like that. And this is only the beginning. So we got to be very mindful in terms of the kind of games that are being played.
Brother Bobby, what's your take on the article? What did you get from the article?
Well, I agree with Brother Hakeem in terms of there's a lot of smoke and mirrors when you look at a decision of this magnitude being made. And, I don't find it unusual given certain comments, if you notice, about there's certain comments in reference to Paul Ryan when he was running as presidential candidate. He expressed this strong support of Ayn Rand, who was a super capitalist, super individualist author. And her economic theory is very similar to what we see today, where it should be okay for there to be this gross imbalance. And if you notice in politics, you see this gross imbalance in terms of how resources are dispersed. You notice those wealthier districts get all the resources, and those that do not have that same accumulation of wealth gets what's left behind. And that's even reflective in terms of academics and social environment. And I can even give you a local example. In the state of Virginia, there's certain areas that are called food deserts where you have to travel further distance to get your grocery store, whereas a more affluent area, they have within a 5-mile radius, there's 8 grocery stores, and there's definitely something to be said about that imbalance.
Okay, Brother Anthony, and this is for Sister Katie. For our listening audience who may not be familiar with the article, I like to read maybe the first 2-3 paragraphs, and I will come back to Brother Anthony and Sister Katie, and I would like for them to respond to the position that the author is raising. And we're going to discuss how valid is this and how can we change this reality. It's stated that I have always found discussions on democracy in the U.S. curious, at a time hilarious, where I have always been impressed by the skillful ways elite contract a narrative of democratic values and practice in a country that is, in reality, the antithesis of a democracy. The fervor with which the fairy tale is embraced, even by intellectuals, has always been a source of curiosity for me. But at the other moment, like the one we are in now, I can't help but find some of the arguments used to support the U.S. Supreme Court recent McCutcheon decision, and even some of the comments laminating how the decisions will destroy democracy in the U.S. somewhat funny. Of course, these are deadly serious times, and the McCutcheon decision, which making it easier for corporate and financial elites to buy elections and candidates is a serious ruling that conveys a devastating single message that the furtherance of the neoliberalism project and the maintenance of the U.S. empire require the evisceration of democracy. That message has always been clear to those of us on the margin who have never been or had the luxury of embracing illusion as a way of life. For us, democracy in the U.S. has always been a zombie democracy, a rotten facsimile that look a little like democracy, sound like democracy, and even has some democratic forms, but was never the real thing, never really alive. Brother Anthony, what you make of that?
Okay.
That kind of representation of this democracy in the United States?
The United States has never been a true democracy. It was at best a bourgeois democracy, in which the bourgeoisie, which are a minority of people in society, exercise control over the majority, which are the masses. And a careful study of the U.S. Constitution shows this, because the original Constitution, as it was originally drafted, only allowed wealthy male Europeans to vote that owned property. It even excluded a majority of the European population, including the American Indian and the Africans who were enslaved, who actually outnumbered, the European ruling class. So what we see from this decision, my view, is a further intensification of capitalism, and that it's becoming more blatant that the bourgeoisie is trying to maintain its control, even doing away with the illusion that the masses of people have input in how they're governed.
Katie, how do you feel about just even this idea of to make this concept of democracy as something very unique, something special, something the greatest thing that America has ever given to the world? But when you look at it in reality, you see it's nothing in reality display what we know a democracy should be in terms of what it really is. How are they able to continue to manipulate us under this concept, particularly given the issues and the problems that we have been confronted with since arriving on the shore? What is just your take on this democracy thing?
I think that we all want to believe that we understand the concept of democracy, but the article that you are sharing tonight really does help to emphasize that it is often an illusion, because the possibility of democracy, as the article points out, was actually aborted by Thomas Jefferson and the white men who owned property. The revolutionaries who declared their independence also aborted this idea. It was not until the American coup in Philadelphia in 1787, when men of property ignored the mandate from their state legislature and strengthened what was called the Articles of Confederation. So they met in secret to show their power. And as you know, men have often met in secret for various reasons. But this secret meeting laid the foundation for the Constitution. And this was an idea that was consolidated by white men who own property. And therefore, they looked at black people as me as 3/4 of a person. Therefore, the idea of democracy is actually an illusion. It's not real, because democracy was never even mentioned in the text itself. So we want to believe that it exists. We look for it. We strive for it, but it doesn't affect us. It's really something that we're reaching for, constantly hoping for, and it's not a reality for us.
So I think by hearing that particular point, Sister Katie, and to my panelists tonight, one of the fundamental questions we have among ourselves as intellectuals to explain to the masses of people, how do we overcome this illusion to make our people realize exactly what it is? But I think earlier in the article, the writer makes a statement that he says that the oppressed, in so many words, the marginalized folks, always knew the reality that this was not a democracy. So now the question, we don't know that it's not a democracy. It's questions, how do we transform whatever this issue is that confronted oppressing our people into something where we can own and control and fit our needs and aspirations? Haki, Anthony, Jabari, and Katie, how do we get past this illusion of striving concretely to make that people realize this is exactly what it is, and how do we make something come to existence that will fit and represent our needs and our aspirations? I'll start with you, Brother Hakeem. That's the issue.
Yeah, well, you know what? I don't know if I agree with the office assumption that the marginalized, in fact, understand, you know, concretely what the situation is in terms of, you know, democracy being a host. I think to a large extent they buy into this notion that, in fact, it is democracy because they hear it on TV. I recently read an article in which they talked about 40% of the American people are illiterate, where 30% are semi-illiterate. So effectively what you're talking about is 70% of the people who can't read and write or interpret a paragraph, which means that those people are beholden to what? The media. So they get their information directly from media. And, of course, because the media is corporate controlled, then we understand only certain precepts, only certain ideas, only certain concepts ever get discussed. And so, therefore, those people who are ill-equipped to go online or to read books or journals to figure out what's going on, they're at the mercy of the corporate state. So I don't think they realize in terms of the democracy is a sham, because if you sit down and you look at young brothers, you know, struggling, you know, on in the community, you know, drug dealing, you know, dealing out all that death, I think the pursuit for them is that, you know, somehow if they get the money, then democracy can become real. They don't deal with the question in terms of the kind of destruction, the kind of chaos that ensues as a result of the practice. So I think this notion that, in fact, that the money is indicative of the fact that, in their minds, democracy is real. So that is my problem. In terms of getting people to understand, you know, the reality in terms of the situation, I think the only thing you can do in terms of that is just keep on, it's just repetition, when you just keep on talking about the situation as it exists. I think to some extent, as the state continues to unwind, as the society, as government continues, global capitalism continues to erode, I think more and more people, I think that's kind of a dialectic that exists in which more and more people will be compelled to confront the reality, whereas now I don't think they are compelled to confront the reality. I think the illusion or the self-deception is strong among so many people that even if you tell them, if you point out what's happening, even in their own lives, when you show them, they're inclined to dismiss what you're saying because I think in their mind, democracy is a legitimate expression of this government. So I think the only thing we can really do in terms of impacting on folks is keep on saying it over and over and over again until they get to the point where they understand it. And also keep in mind, there is a human imperative in terms of not dealing with the fact that this is no real democracy. If you realize this is not a democracy, then not only do you have to take some responsibility, but then you also have to understand that your longevity, that your life, that your aspirations are on some level in peril. And I don't think people want to even deal with that. It's easy for them to believe the illusion that it's okay, it's all good, that in fact people are homeless because they want to be homeless. People are not unemployed because they want to be unemployed, or people don't have food because, you know, they're too lazy to get out and work. So I think it's called a kind of a human imperative, in which it's easier for people to believe this nonsense as opposed to spread through dealing with reality. So I think only repetition is going to change that, along with the erosion of the conditions that are going to compel people to start looking at what's going on. I think only then will people be, you know, amenable to the idea in terms of why this is not a democracy, why democracy doesn't exist in society. So I think that's what's going to have to happen.
Okay, Anthony?
Okay, I think, let's see, I concur with the points being made so far. And I would add that the way, the only way democracy could come to this society is a change in the economic system from one of exploitation to one in which, every human being is treated equally. And that's never been the case in U.S. history. There's always been this illusion of democracy because we do not have, the masses do not have that ability to analyze history correctly. And that's something that we have to move to change. Those of us who know more have a certain responsibility to convey that. And the two main mechanisms that the ruling class uses to prevent this consciousness from developing is the control of the educational system and the control of the media. And we have to add the control of the educational system in addition to the media, because that's usually where the ideas and the illusions are germinated. And if people want democracy, then you have to struggle to build a socialist society. But the people have to be organized in order to be able to bring that about. Because unfortunately, our enemy is very well organized. And as long as that's the case, until we get organized, we cannot bring about that change that will create a genuine democracy.
Okay, we'd like to pause for a second and allow our listening audience to let them know that they are listening to a special episode of Africa on the Move. We are in the process of looking at expanding our program from a bi-weekly show to a weekly show. You can catch us normally on every other Sunday at 6 p.m., but tonight this is a special episode, and it also is a work in progress. We are in the process of learning the very technology so we can be more effective in terms of trying to communicate ideas to the public, and particularly to the African community. Right now, we do have a chat line open. You are welcome to call in or write in our chat line. And we are now opening up our phone lines where you can call in and share your views and opinions or raise questions with our panelists tonight as we speak on various issues and subjects. Our call-in number tonight is 323-679-0841. 323-679-0841. Please call in if you'd like to speak, have a question. Make sure you hit number one. Make sure you hit number one if you have a question that you would like to answer, or if you have a comment that you'd like to make. Hit number one, and we will recognize you by your last four digits in your phone number. We will recognize you by your last four digits by your phone number. Please hit number one so we can recognize you. Okay, let's continue to move forward. Our phone lines are open now. To Sister Katie, in terms of one of the things, you know, I think that we sometimes have a tendency to speak theoretically on ideas and concepts, which has its value. And then there are some practical applications on this whole concept of democracy. Now, one reason why we ask for you to be a host or be a panelist on our shows is there's a particular case we want to keep out in the public, because we are trying to help a young man who typifies the missions of a lot of our young men around the country. They are being framed and used by the system. Can you just give us briefly an update on what's going on with Michael Fulton and apply this in terms of some of the things we discussed tonight, in terms of this whole thing about African people having money, but it doesn't transcend to the everyday brothers and sisters, and so the question of how democracy has been played out as it relates to your son's case. So can you give us an update, please, Katie, on your son, Michael Fulton?
I think that one of the panelists really did hit the button whenever he said that it is a matter of income and that the media is very powerful. We recently saw the district attorney on the case was using the media in an effort to shape his agenda. And we understand that he thinks that the media would be able to support his agenda no matter how unfair it is, because as the panelists pointed out, people are not able to look at the case itself and read the issues involved. And I think that as long as you have people with money who are able to manipulate and skew the views through the mass media, we are going to be struggling to survive in a democracy. My son is still struggling to survive because he understands that this case that they have built against him is based solely on a computer. And a computer is one of those things in our society today that can be used and hacked and manipulated and undermine your existence. And this is what he's depending on. The DA, Christopher Gallo, he knows that my son is not guilty, but he's gone to the media today and yesterday in an effort to shape the views of the public, to help them come to the realization that, well, if he's black and he's charged, that he has to prove that he's innocent because you're guilty. You automatically assume to be guilty. And I think it's important that people of color understand that we really do need to have not only an involvement, an open mind, but we also need to question what the mass media is showing you, because they often skew the view. And if you don't read, if you don't ask, if you don't stand still and take a note as to what they're showing you, you really and truly are misinformed. We need to have a paradigm shift. Once we have a paradigm shift, then we're able to keep an open mind and say, you know, I heard that and I saw that, but I have to check that out. I need to check that out before I, you know, really and truly follow the crowd. So I understand the power of the mass media. I saw it. I see it in action every day. And my son is still struggling to survive. He knows that this is an uphill battle. And he knows that the way the DA has brought this case in a county we've never lived in, he stands to face an all-white jury. I don't have to tell you, a young black male going before an all-white jury, he's rolling the dice.
Ms. Fulton, if you can,
just
briefly, Ms. Fulton, just give a general background on who is your son and you know, how productive has he been in terms of for the last, let's say, 10, 12 years of his life? Why would he be in such a predicament? What's the motivation behind it? If our audience, there's a new audience that's listening to your program who knows nothing about your case, please, this is your time to share it with our people.
My son is a young black male that grew up from middle school into high school in the state of Colorado. He graduated with honors from Englewood High School. He was recruited into college at the University of Colorado in Boulder. He finished his degree in Boulder, and he was recruited into a minority engineering program. He's never had a problem with law enforcement, but a few months ago, they seized his computer, and now they're saying that information on his computer can be used to build a case against him. And the people who seized the computer are individuals in the county of Douglas County, a county we've never lived in. We don't know anyone who lives in Douglas County, but they seem determined to destroy this young man's future. by the information that they have seized off of his computer. They connected themselves to us because they had people that they said had gone online and found that information was coming in to his computer. He was not even home when they came and seized his computer. So now they're continuing to build a case, and they're manipulating the information to the judge, and now they're manipulating the information to the community, and they're hoping that no one cares enough about us or enough about my son's future to ask the right questions or to get involved. So you're looking at, as I said before, people who are really and truly being challenged with a paradigm shift. We are struggling, and we are asking for help, and we do need support. But until we can tap into the community and help them to understand that these charges are bogus and these charges are unfair and that the community really doesn't know the truth, they're swiping us with this brush and making it appear as if we are guilty of charges that we are not.
What can they do and how can they reach you?
If you need to have additional information, we ask that you call us at 720-499-5146. We ask that you call us, or you can also email us, saveoursons2013@gmail.com. We will respond to you. If you have an idea, if you want to make a donation in the defense fund, you could write to us, Post Office Box 58, Englewood, Colorado, 80151, attention, Save Our Sons Defense Fund. We will respond to you. But for now, we are struggling, and we're hoping and praying that someone who's listening will understand that this is a case that really does need to be addressed fairly and honestly in a court of law. They have asked my son to take a plea deal, and he says no, he doesn't want to take a plea deal. He thinks that it's important not to take a plea deal and plead to something that he's not guilty of. So he says that he'll just have to take his chances and go to trial and hope that people on jury will understand that these charges are bogus and there's no foundation for the charges at all.
Okay. We'd like to encourage our audience. We are advocating on Michael Fulton's behalf that if you can have any kind of resources that you can help out and allow the brother to get the proper representation that he deserves and needs. And if we also we are a family, this is a time and this is a concrete example that we must and should respond to. So please, if you're in a position to do anything financially to help him out to get the legal representation, please do so. But more importantly, we'd like for you to educate yourself on this case and share this with the general public. I think, like the brother said earlier, one of the things they do in the media is they often say the same thing over and over and over, even though not the truth, and how you begin to believe that it is the truth. So we must find ways where we can properly inform ourselves. So, again, we highly encourage you to come to the aid to this mother and her son, and they're also an extension of our community. And talking about extension of our community, we can go from that particular example from Colorado to Milwaukee. There was recently an article that was written called Milwaukee, a Third World City. And from this article, I'd like to read two paragraphs quickly, and we'd like to get some response from our panelists on this article. It says, in referencing hyper-segregation and the lack of adequate resources, Casey added a few statistics that resulted from this phenomenon. He stated that when 1 in 8 black men in the state have been incarcerated, and half of all black men 30 and younger have been incarcerated, then we have a problem that needs to be discussed. And yes, race is a part of that conversation. If white males who are incarcerated at a rate of 1 to 81 were incarcerated at the same rate of black males, everyone would be asking how to fix the problem. Even though Wisconsin has 72 counties, almost 50% of our state prisoners come from one county, Milwaukee. The city comprised about 11% of the state population, but last year, 49% of the state homicides occurred in Milwaukee. So I would just stop right there, and we had a chance to look at this article, and it was talking about how the conditions in Milwaukee really was a plantation, and the question came, was it really was a plantation, or were there just certain factors that exist that are very similar to plantations? And reading the article, Brother Jabari, I'd like to get your feedback on that. What were some of the things that you saw were striking in terms of when you read the article on the state of Milwaukee? And we understand that when it comes to African people, it's the worst state in the country in terms of getting economic justice and all of the things that you need to really just assist as a human being. Brother Jababi, would you like to respond to the article? Milwaukee?
Excuse me. Yes, I'm going to let you know that I'm going to depart shortly afterwards. But nonetheless, in response to what you were saying, it's obvious that it was institutionalized because we look at the city of Milwaukee. You're talking about conditions that not only hinder success, but they hinder future success because you're talking about when you look at the back down in terms of academic success, black students are so far behind their white counterparts, there's almost something that's very eerie about that, that there's such a big discrepancy. It's not only just them, but students of other nationalities as well that are considered minorities. And it's definitely a question of fairness, a question of whose interests those that are in control are working in, as well as what's really being done to level the playing field and actually create a quality state of living than this separate cities that you see within one city. You see a separate balance, basically, that's creating alternative reality for some while others, you know, thrive off of their great ability to have success because things are biased in their favor.
Okay. Brother Anthony, what did you make of this particular article? What could you take from it? The value of our people knowing, should know about.
Well, the thing that that struck me about this article is that that even though Milwaukee is an extreme example, possibly, it's not too different from other cities in the U.S. in terms of the fact that levels of incarcerations of African males tend to be substantially higher than their European counterparts, and those of other nationalities as well. And also the level of poverty, unemployment, tends to be a lot worse in the African communities throughout the U.S., not just in Milwaukee. But the thing that struck me was you know, the degree in which the class and national struggle is being played out there, and I think you know, I think that's an interesting dynamic in the fact that the level of poverty among the African population and also the level of exploitation that exists, you know, is what stuck out for me.
And for you, Haki, what stood out for you, Haki, when you read the article?
Well, I think a couple of things. I think we have to understand the role in terms of deindustrialization, you know, particularly in American cities. When the brother alluded to the fact that no jobs and no opportunity for youth in terms of, you know, being actually able to, you know, to sustain themselves, you know, to do the kind of things they want to do in terms of a productive adult life. So we have to understand that that's one of the problems. I think also this issue in terms of we can't underscore just how much a part the government play in terms of facilitating large number of African men being incarcerated. The thing is that normally we don't talk a great deal about the terms of the kind of grants, you know, the federal government provides, you know, locales in terms of cleaning up crime. In other words, there's an incentive in terms of locking up a large number of young African-American males because there's money to be had by locales versus citizen states. So that's one of the things we don't talk about. But all of this is implicit. I mean, all of this is the direct result of the global capitalism, and we have to understand that. You can't have a situation in which, you know, a large amount of your wealth is accrued to the 1% of the population, and think that you're going to have economic expansion. That's not going to happen. As a consequence of giving a large number of money to 1% of the population, then not only do you impoverish a large number of people, but you have a lot of people who don't have access to jobs, who don't have access to shelter, who don't have access to hope. And so, therefore, the question immediately becomes, what do you do with all this large number of people that you don't have any use for? Under global capitalist system, the solution is you incarcerate them. You incarcerate them. This is why people for nonviolent offenses in terms of marijuana usage get long terms in prison. Now, the strange thing about this is that, you know, when you think about the disparity between, you know, marijuana or even crack cocaine versus powder cocaine, it seems obvious to me that there are other considerations at play as opposed to justice. That the considerations have more to do with a political consideration and not in terms of what's legit or what's fair. And so we have to, and I think we have to understand, I think implicit in our thinking, we have to begin to understand that whether we want to or not, we have to understand that we're under siege. And so when Sister Katie talked about what happened to her son, it's indicative of the mindset in terms of as it relates to those in the society who perceive as esoteric or those who existence is superfluous. And so we got to understand that irrespective of how much money you make or what kind of job you do and all that stuff, the color of your skin, in fact, is tantamount to, you know, a real danger. And we have to understand this is the thing. So that is my view in terms of that article.
Okay, what we're going to do right now, I believe we have some callers who may like to have their views or comment heard. We can call your last phone number. And we'd like to welcome you to Africa on the Move. And a caller right now, we're going to give caller number 1108 the opportunity to give their views or comment. Caller, welcome to Africa on the Move. Caller 1108. Any question or comment, please, caller. Caller 1108. Okay, let's try the next caller. Caller 3282. Caller 3282. Welcome to Africa on the Move. Any questions or comments, please? Okay, I think our callers just listen to the conversation. We'd like to welcome them. Let them continue to listen. Let's continue the discussion. In terms of this question, Milwaukee, you know, I thought it'd be interesting when he talked about the equate Milwaukee as being a part of a slave plantation. And he gave some characteristics of the city. And one of the things he stated was that he said the primary basis for Briscoe's assertion is that Milwaukee is, in Kelsey's words, hyper-segregated. Hyper-segregation extends the system of racial segregation in terms of grouping racial groups geographically, one, two, and is, according to Massey and Dayton, a global construction that is comprised of five dimensions of segregation, which include evenness, clustering, exposure, centralization, and concentration. When a city has all five dimensions, i.e., it is considered hyper-segregated. The result of this hyper-segregation is that those residents who are the least affluent receive the least exposure to the quality of life and resources available to them. The most affluent of residents, in terms of its minority population and its level of segregation, Milwaukee has all five dimensions. Now, when you talk about that, it seems like to me that a lot of cities will fit that characteristics. What would you say about that, Sister Katie and Brother Hackey?
I think that the article really does help understand that what the brother said a few minutes ago is that it's all by design. It's not by accident that Milwaukee has all five dimensions. You can see that as you observe and assess the conditions that exist in Milwaukee. It's by design. As he so eloquently pointed out, many of them are living in a state of hopelessness. And many of them around the world, not just in Milwaukee, are serving long sentences for marijuana, possession of marijuana, using marijuana. And as you know, in the state of Colorado, they've made marijuana legal. So there's a double standard. You have one part of the country that has gone through the laws and using the laws to skew their view and allow them to do what they want to do, and it's to their advantage. So it's a double standard. Again, I say it's by design. It's not by accident that black males are not only being profiled and targeted and denied an opportunity to enjoy the livelihood of life itself, but they get to a point where they live in a state of hopelessness. They just try to exist. They're not living. They're just holding on. And this is capitalized in the article, The State of Milwaukee. And I think that when you talk about black men in general, you will see a double standard throughout the country, regardless if it's jobs, housing, education, income, there's a double standard. There's another article, sex crimes, and they usually look for either sex crimes or drugs to bring our men into incarceration. And as the young panel said before, many of our young men are incarcerated because they don't have any need for them in society. Society has seen that they're useless. There was a University of Pennsylvania young white male that was caught with a lot of pornography, child pornography, on his computer. He was not charged with a felony. He was charged with a misdemeanor. But the black male, in the same court, on the same charge, was charged with a felony. So as long as you have individuals who are able to manipulate the criminal system and skew it to their view and use it to undermine one group and help another group, you're going to have this kind of existence that you see in the market. It's by design. It's not by accident.
Okay. Well, you know, speaking of this being charged, I want to go back earlier to the program, and then we'll come back to Brother Anthony, but to Brother Hackey. You made a statement about, I think, an incident that took place earlier, I believe it was in the state of Nevada, where, you know, a group of men went out west to protect this particular farmer, wealthy farmer, who cows were grazing on federal government property, and they ended up drawing guns on federal marshals. And they received no charges, no charges at all. I found that real amazing. It says, I thought if you drew a gun on any federal marshals, you automatically would have some kind of legal response. What could we make up to that kind of response or lack of response? Can we just, I would like to just get some feedback from my audience tonight, as well as from our panelists, Brother Hackey. What do you make of that kind of response? Or the marshals just withdrew and nothing was done to those who drew guns on their employees?
I think, you know what, I think at some point we got to deal with some hard reality. I think the perception or how society wants, you know, black men to be perceived is very, very important. There's a reason why they want us to be perceived as criminal-minded. There's a reason behind that. I think that, you know, we're a convenient scapegoat in terms of the kind of shenanigans that are going on in terms of the economic system where all the wealth is being given to a few people. And so therefore, you know, scapegoating us serves two purposes. Not only does it make other people feel superior because they're somehow not like us, you know, somehow we're coming to mind and they're not. And also it serves a purpose in terms of filling up, you know, these private prisons, for-profit prisons. And so, therefore, we have to understand that in terms of the economic incentive, in terms of filling up these prisons, you know, it's done at the expense of black youth. Now, in terms of these guys out in Nevada, in terms of the reason why they're able to pull their guns out on the federal marshals and get away with it, is because they have the backing of very powerful right-wing individuals inside the government. And the thing that we have to understand is that we should not believe that, in fact, that every time we talk about the KKK, the Nazis, or skinheads, so forth and so on, that we're talking about ill-educated, undereducated, or just ignorant white folks. We're talking about a lot of powerful white folks in powerful positions pulling the strings, and we have to understand that. And we have to understand that because when we look at the flow of history, when you look at Italy, fascist Italy, or you look at Nazi Germany, and you look at the kind of manipulation in terms of the people, in terms of getting the people to fight each other, we have to understand it's a useful tactic. And so, therefore, everything they do is geared specifically toward making sure that African people are perceived as the other. And so, therefore, as the time economy continues to deteriorate, then they can conveniently say, listen, we support people like the ranchers out in Nevada because they're us. But those other people, those black people, the enemy, you know, we need to deal with them. Action, but it's an abstraction that historically has always worked in terms of those in power manipulating people to fight each other, why, you know, those people who create the problems in the first place are safe. So this is the reason why they were able to pull out their guns on the federal marshals and get away with it. And now I venture to say, if they were African people and they pulled something like that, not only will they had returned with hundreds of sheriffs, but somebody would have died that day. All those people would have been in prison if they had been African people. But because they were white and they represent the sentiment, you know, of the powerful, those right-wing politicians, right-wing corporate types, you know, who actually wield power, they were able to get away with what they were doing. And so we have to understand the real implicit danger. A lot of people don't appreciate that. They somehow want you to believe that when you talk about these racist groups and you talk about these poor, ill-educated, ignorant white folks, but that is not the problem. That is not your problem. Your problem is wealthy, powerful, well-connected white folks who wear suits, you know, who work in corporate America, who work in law offices, who work in the military, who have power. This is the real problem that we're confronted with. So we have to understand clearly in terms of why these people in Nevada were able to point guns at federal marshals as opposed to, you know, federal marshals taking charge. They fled. It's unheard of. But this is the dynamics in terms of what's going on and why our people got to become organized and understand just how serious the situation is.
Okay, I believe we have Brother Anthony, 7075. Are you there?
Yes, I am.
Yes,
Brother Anthony.
No problem. What is your take on this Nevada thing, this response or lack of response? We heard Hackey analysis. I'd like to hear yours, considering.
Okay. Let's see. I concur with Hackey on his analysis. Pretty much, I would add that what it represents is the fact that even in spite of our successes, our advancements, our struggle, racism is alive and well, and it's very real. And the thing about it, though, and the Ku Klux Klan and these other forces are backed by very powerful Europeans. And it should be pointed out here that the Ku Klux Klan was founded in a law office in Pulaski, Tennessee, in the late 19th century. So the legal system in the society, has never been an ally. I think that situation speaks to the need that there is this double standard that Ms. Fulton had alluded to in terms of how people of different ethnic groups are treated in this society.
Speaking of Ms. Fulton, looking at how this judicial system is playing out in terms of the Sun case, and looking at what just recently happened in Nevada that we just spoke of, how do you see this how law is being implemented, Ms. Fulton, as relates to when you get this Nevada case? You know they commit a crime when you drew a gun on marshals, but yet nothing has been done. But yet you have a son who has done nothing, and they are trying to seem to indict him or creating false evidence. But I'd just like to hear your response.
Yes, sir. I appreciate that. I do agree with the panelists that have spoken, and I do understand, and you understand as well, that the young man you're speaking of, well, he's not so young, but I think his name is Cliven Bundy. And when he took the position that he took and said that he's not going to pay for using it and allowing his cows to graze on the land, he's saying that he doesn't have any respect at all for the law. He doesn't have any respect at all for the Constitution. He's saying to us publicly and boldly that he's going to do it his way because he has no respect and he doesn't have to abide by the rules that we have to abide by. And he's got support in his stance because thousands came to his aid in the media and on the ground. They came to his aid and supported him and said, well, you know, he owes $1 million to the federal government that he has not paid, and he said, I'm not going to pay. But you and I both know that if we fell behind, and my son is proof of that, because they will charge him and they will have him pay to wear an ankle bracelet. And he'll have to pay. If not, he'll suffer the consequences. And you see it over and over again in our society. There's a double standard. 33 people died 2 years ago in Colorado when they had the cantaloupe. The cantaloupe started to poison people, kill people. The Jensen Farm brothers, their sentence was reduced because there was no restitution ordered. The maximum that anyone complained came to a total of $13,000. We said, okay, $13,000. We can deal with that. We're going to reduce their penalty. So, again, if these were black farmers and they caused the death of 33 people in one state, you would have a different kind of penalty handed down. So, yes, there's a double standard in the criminal justice system. And you see it play out right before your eyes. This man in Nevada has no intention of doing what he thinks is right or wrong. He's just going to do it his way because he's white male. Because he's saying that this is his world and he's in control.
See, very clear. And for some reason or other, I wonder where is this African press when these kind of contradictions come up. And they never attempt to try to highlight it, inflame it, or just remind our people of these realities and contradictions. Where's the African press and all this stuff, Haki? Why aren't they responding?
Well, I think African press is afflicted with the same kind of inertia that I think people generally are afflicted by. I mean, this notion that you know, to keep the dollars coming in, then you got to play ball. In other words, you have to deny the African masses certain information if you want to keep those white dollars rolling into your paper. So I think they're caught up in the same bind. I mean, but I think you do have some independent black organizations that do deal with that theme. They haven't dealt with that theme yet in terms of what's happening in Nevada yet. But I would surmise that at some point they will deal with that in terms of the implications, in terms of, you know, what happened and how things played themselves out in Nevada. But I think generally, you know, there's no question. And historically, one of the problems we had in terms of, you know, the role of black papers is that they were indistinguishable from the white papers in terms of information that is useful, information that is empowering, information that's going to get people to think critically was absent in the African newspapers. And so we always ask the question, then what is the concrete difference between the two? If in fact, you know, got the white newspaper feeding me BS, and then the African newspaper feeding me the same BS, then so what is the use? I mean, what is the viability in terms of a black newspaper if it's not going to do the things to empower the community? So it's a historical argument. But I don't think that, certainly not in terms of, you know, those black papers who have large circulations. I would anticipate on them actually dealing with what happened in Nevada because they stand to lose too much money. I don't think that's going to happen. And now recently I listening to this guy named Joe, last name is George. I think his first name was Michael George, I think it was. Anyway, assistant editor for the New York Post. And now anybody who knows anything about the New York Post knows it's a rag. I mean, it's the most scandalous, you know, undocumented trash ever existed in terms of the annals of newspapers. But this black guy attempted to defend, in fact, this what happened in Nevada, he attempted to defend the actions of those farmers out there in Nevada, saying that they may have some legitimacy in terms of what they were doing. Now, clearly there's no legitimacy. I mean, if you're stealing, you're stealing. If you're wrong, you're wrong. I'm not validating or justifying, government overreach by any stretch of the imagination. But what I'm saying that if you're wrong, you're wrong, and it's as simple as that in terms of laws. And so, therefore, for this black editor to defend, you know, these ranches, it speaks volumes in terms of the kind of fear that is so prevalent in these newsrooms in terms of, you know, black folks actually trying, you know, to publish real news. It simply doesn't happen. And it's clear from listening to this guy, he was conflicted, but he had to keep the job. So to keep that job, he had to toe the line that which the line in which the right wing wanted him to toe, which is that the white guy was in his rights, the government was wrong. Now, of course, if he were black, it would have been the other way around. The black guy would have been wrong, and the government is right. So clearly, you know, this has been a historical problem in terms of the black press.
Okay, let's make a final transition for tonight. One of the things Africa on the Move would like to do and seek to do is to inform our people on very important institutions and events that comes up periodically in our community. We have a very long historical event and institution that's coming, that will be taking place next month. That will be May the 17th in Washington, D.C., and that event is called African Liberation Day. We've been talking about all of the issues, conditions, and problems of African people here in America and throughout. Let's take a look at African Liberation Day and see how it may play a role in the problems that afflicts our people in the United States and throughout the world. And with that subject tonight, we would like Ms. Brother Anthony to give us an update on the general purpose of Royal African Liberation Day and what can we expect and what's going on this year for AID 2014. Brother Anthony?
Okay, as you correctly point out, we are organizing a commemoration of African Liberation Day, which has been organized for nearly 56 years since it was founded in Ghana in 1958. This year we're commemorating African Liberation Day on May 17th at the Festival Center in Washington, D.C. The theme for this year is Smash the Neocolonialist Intelligentsia, the True Face of the Counter-Revolution. And the reason why we chose this theme is based upon, our experiences, within our organization and in the broader African community in general. And it is at the root of a lot of the problems we have been talking about tonight. Let's see. There is a segment of our people that work in the service of our enemies, the capitalist bourgeoisie. And that comes from this neocolonialist intelligentsia. Just a quick note: neocolonialism is a form of is a sham independence. In other words, it is a system of imperialism in which the people are given the illusion of freedom, but really all of their interests and their resources are externally controlled by enemy forces. And that's what, let's see, Africans have been confronted with since the last half of the 20th century. And it was formulated in response to the upsurge in the struggle for Africans to achieve genuine independence. And it was devised by capitalism to thwart that aim. It originated in Central and South America and the Caribbean to thwart the freedom aspirations of the American Indians and Africans in that part of the Western Hemisphere. And it's, yeah.
Look, I'll finish your point, brother. If I mean to cut you off, go ahead.
All right, and it started shortly after Haiti was able to defeat the forces of French colonialism back in the early 1800s. And in response, and because Haiti had aided various forces in Central South America in getting its independence, that the capitalists devised neocolonialism as a means to put a check on our people's struggle for genuine progress and freedom.
Yeah, we often talk about how do we move our people forward, and we know our people must have some vehicle to move forward. Can you discuss the host group at this African Liberation Day and tell us a little bit of history about this group and how do you see solving the problems of our people?
Okay. This African Liberation Day is being organized by the All African People's Revolutionary Party, GC, which is a mass-based, independent, political, socialist party based in Africa that was founded by Asantefo, Kwame Nkrumah in 1968, and we're continuing the legacy of Kwame Nkrumah, Sekou Touré, and Kwame Touré, the foremost exponents of revolutionary Pan-Africanism, the total liberation and unification of Africa under scientific socialism. Our task at the present time is to organize a body of cadre that can educate the masses of our people to help them organize in order to defeat the forces of imperialism in Africa and worldwide.
Okay, and Brother Anthony, can you give us a sense, when it comes to African Liberation Day, for people who may have heard of it firsthand and never been, what can they expect? What kind of organizations and groups will be there? What the nature of the program that you will have, and would it be geared towards, how would it be geared towards in terms of relating to the daily people problems and solving them? What can we expect?
Sure.
Yeah,
okay. Well, African Liberation Day is held every year in order to mark the onward progress of Africans in terms of achieving their freedom. Let's see. We use African Liberation Day consists of symposiums in which representatives of various revolutionary, progressive, and socialist organizations provide updates on their struggle and address the accomplishments or obstacles toward achieving the further organization and freedom of our people. You can expect that this year that at our symposium that there'll be representatives of various revolutionary, political, or progressive organizations from throughout the world, providing an update on the progress of their struggles in their respective parts of the world. And we'll be speaking on also how the neocolonialist intelligentsia is hindering our efforts to achieve, you know, our freedom, and also present a solution, which is Pan-Africanism. And we view this as the solution, because that the control that our inability and lack of control of Africa means that we lack the resources to really develop ourselves economically, politically, culturally, etc. So we view the liberation of African people as a key part in our contribution to the struggle to achieve socialism.
And where can people go and find out more information about the organization and the party and African Liberation Day?
People can visit our website at www.aprp-gc.org. And you'll find information about African Liberation Day this year, the logistical information and theme, as well as previous African Liberation Days, and information about various organizations that we've worked with currently and in the past, and information about the history of our organization, and how people can get involved, as well as various positions on various issues affecting our community.
Okay, and to Brother Haki, Brother Haki, you are also fond of saying the importance of how people recognize the need to create institutions. Well, we know African Liberation Day is an institution. It's been in existence since 1958. The whole Pan-African movement came into existence in the early 1900s. How valuable, why is it important for us to maintain and continue to help be a support this institution that we call African Liberation Day? What it means to you? And have you ever been to one, and what did you get from it?
Yeah, I have been to one. Yeah, I make a point of going every year, when I can. But I think essentially the importance to the masses of folks is clearly, there's an old adage, unless Africa free, no African anywhere in the world is free. I think it's very, very true. Until, Africa is united under socialist government, scientific socialist government, then no Africa's going to be true. Now, there's an analogy. When you look at in terms of the historical treatment of the Chinese, it was very, very horrible. But now you look at the treatment of Chinese on television now, which is totally different, much more positive. And the reason being is because China is very, very strong economically. So we have to have a united Africa and a science socialist system. It's the only way to defeat global imperialism. It's the only way we can do it. It's the only way to bring in a new paradigm, one that has respect for humanity, one that teaches people to love and teaches people to get along. So so it's very, very important that people come out and support African Liberation Day, because it's in not only the best interest of African people, but people throughout the world.
Now, Brother Anthony and Brother Haki, and you hold on, Sister Katie, we're coming to you. We haven't forgotten about you. I would like to raise this question with Brother Anthony and Brother Haki. You said that S-word that people are scared of, socialism. What is it about socialism that will have an impact on our people's lives once we achieve it? Because, in the press, they wouldn't talk about socialism, even in the so-called African press. They never say really good things about socialism. But this is a socialist institution, and I advocate socialism. What is in that history? What is in that struggle? What is in the concept of trying to be a social society that will make human beings not only more responsible, but also more productive and just? Brother Anthony, talk to me a little bit about this question of socialism. Why socialism?
Socialism is the solution to our problems of exploitation and oppression. The reason for that is because socialism involves the control of the resources by the masses, that is the majority of our people, and also the participation of the majority of the people, the masses of the people, if you will, in the development of the resources of their society for their benefit. It provides a power base from which, to develop economically, and it's only under those conditions that that genuine democracy that the masses of the people desire can be realized. And it's not realizable under this system because the system of capitalism, the principle is the acquisition of as much wealth as possible by the individual by any means necessary. And the problems that we had discussed earlier, the problems of unemployment, impoverishment, injustice, can only be addressed under a just system, a system in which the resources of society are under the control of the masses of the people, and wealth is for the development of the whole society and not just a few individuals.
And Brother Haki, why are you advocating socialism? What is it about socialism that will help our people move forward?
Well, let me just put it in the context. One of the things, the reason why we're headed toward chaos, the reason why the country's headed toward destruction, is because of the kind of selfishness and greed and avarice that exists in the society, the system which props up all the worst in human beings. Socialism seeks to be more humane in terms of dispossession of resources. I think that when you look at the American economy, one of the things that the thing that saved American economy is socialism. When you look back when Obama became president four and a half years back, when he became president, when the economy was on decline because of the so-called housing debacle. You have to understand it was socialism that saved the country. In other words, there was a distribution of wealth, to these banks, to these giant corporations that saved America. It was socialism. And, of course, nobody in power would call it what it was, which is socialism. So socialism simply seeks to use the resources in a way which is palatable to the masses of people, that benefits the masses of people. And so all these problems that the brother alluded to in terms of unemployment, homelessness, lack of shelter and so forth, on seeks to become an issue that we operate in more humane circumstances. But it's extremely important that socialism is important because global capitalism, as it exists, is going to ensure chaos, fighting destruction on a mass scale. And if Africans in America who think that somehow that it's not going to affect you, then think again. It's going to affect you, and it's coming down the road. And those in power understand that. In fact, I recently read an article in which this guy was employed with the World Bank was talking about the fact that, because the ruthlessness of capitalism, because it doesn't care about human life, that everything is treated as commodity, then large number of people have to die in order for capitalism to live. And so, therefore, capitalism is not anybody's interest in terms of, their aspirations or longevity on this planet. So socialism is a system, it's a more humane system, in terms of providing people for what they need, enhancing human development, creating a situation where you don't have endless wars that are facilitated by a system like capitalism. So socialism is extremely important in terms of the aspiration of African people and humanity generally.
And Sister Katie, our brother Malcolm left us a legacy, and one of the things he left us to learn as a result of history is that he said that only strong Africa will produce a strong African no matter where they are. Give me your understanding or your position on the unity between the Africans here in the United States and the Africans at home. Why is that important in terms of our future survival?
I think it's important that we know our history. As long as you know our history and where you where you stem from, you will have a sense of who you are moving forward. Regardless of the geographical locations and all of the disputes, the oldest living ancestries were still found in the continent of Africa, which means that manhood, life itself, began in the continent of Africa. Therefore, we cannot ignore the planet. We cannot ignore the continent. We cannot ignore the humanity of African people because we are bound together by our heritage. In addition to that, I think it's important, and I'd like to close with this, that one of the panelists said eloquently before that sometimes we find our American blacks in a position that they are manipulated by the income. They're desperate to keep the job, and they make them toe that rope. When we go to court in Douglas County, when my son, the district attorney is white, the judge is white, but he always finds a way to bring in an assistant district attorney that's black, so they know how to play that game. The black people that they bring in and sit beside them is just a mirror to say, see, we're not prejudiced. We're not doing her son wrong because we have a happy black here. And this black is able to help us undermine them. It's important to know who you are, where you are, and what price they make some of our black people pay to keep those jobs. It's important to understand that we are defined by our existence and the income level in America, and that's unfortunate. But if we can just have a strength of heart not to give in and not to be manipulated by the job, we can do an awful good for black people in America and the blacks in Africa.
Okay, in that closing statement, we are running out of time. In that closing statement, Brother Aki, give me your final thoughts to the people tonight based upon some of the ideas and issues that we have discussed, and what is it that you want to leave with them for tonight?
I would only say that, you know, it's important that we confront reality. We can ill afford at this point in history to pretend like all is okay. We have to educate ourselves in terms of what's truly going on, even if that means it's going to cause some distress in your life. It's important because that's just thing to deteriorate. Then, you know, there are no winners. And in particular, when we talk about African people specifically, then we got to be very, very clear in terms of who that other constitute and who that enemy is. And so for the system, that you have to have enemies. And so for African people, we got to be very, very clear in terms of what's coming down the pike, and we have to be organized to be prepared for whatever comes at us.
That was Brother Aki from the African Awareness Association. Sister Katie, give us your final thoughts on how we again can help support your son, Michael.
Thank you. I appreciate the opportunity, and I encourage you to inquire and get more understanding about what is happening in our community, because we are definitely under attack. Many of us are being profiled. Many of us are being targeted. And there are charges that are being brought against my son now that are attempts to destroy his future and his life in general. We are having to fight back as hard as we can to shed light on the situation. And we ask the public to contact us at any time, and we'll be glad to share information. You can call 720-499-5146, or you can write Save Our Sons Defense Fund, Post Office Box 58, Englewood, Colorado, 80151. We continue the struggle, and we ask for your support. We appreciate the opportunity to share our story with you. Thank you for your time.
And Brother F.E., can you talk to the people and invite them to come out to African Liberation Day, and how can they also get in touch with all African people out there by the GNC?
Okay, I'd be glad to share that with you. I would encourage, you know, everybody all of the audience to support African Liberation Day by attending, by checking out us out on the web. our you can find out more about African Liberation Day and our organization by contacting us at 202-719-0529 or email us at info@aaprp-gc.org. Our web address is www.aaprp-gc.org. And I will leave you with this thought that Pan-Africanism is the solution to the problems that we're confronted with presently.
Excellent. To our panelists and our listening audience, on behalf of Africa on the Move, as your host, Brother African, I would like to thank you for allowing us the opportunity to come to your homes and to share with you some timely topics and ideas that we hope will be used as a means to help elevate our people and our community. One of our attempts tonight is to struggle in the arena of ideas because ideas are very important. It's only through ideas, it's only through unity ideas that will lay the proper foundation for our unity of action. Our people don't lack unity of action, but we need unity of ideas. And the best way to overcome this confusion is to create a forum like this one where we can struggle with one another so we can come to arrive at what is the best solution, what is the correct understanding, where people are at this point in time in the field of ideas. On that note, we'll see you next Friday at the same time, same place. Please share with your friends at Join Africa on the Move. It's a program that seeks to speak truth to power, but more importantly, it's a program where we're going to talk to you from an African perspective and from African experiences. Until next time, remember, a Luther continued, yes, the struggle will continue, must continue, and we see you next week. Thank you for listening to Africa on the Move.